Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And calls for a crackdown on soaring investment fraud, Marcus livens up this year's ISA season, and the mortgage prisoners trapped in high-interest loans for over a decade. Will a law change finally offer an escape? Also today, Deliveroo doesn't deliver the goods on its much-anticipated stock market debut. And forget hot tubs and garden furniture. This pandemic summer is all about the camper van, and VW have just gone and made it affordable. But is it any good? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, scams of all sorts, we've discussed it on this pod before, have been soaring during the pandemic. Criminals taking advantage of increased online activity, are working from home, but also our financial vulnerabilities, pressures, and rock-bottom interest rates. Online investment fraud is no different. The City Watchdog reports that throughout 2020, on average, we lost just over 45 grand each on fraudsters imitating genuine investment firms. Now, This Is Money have been speaking to Phil Rolfe, a financial crime expert and chief exec of P2 Consulting, who says that urgent action needs to be taken now. Simon, we've spoken about scams during the pandemic before and the reasons why. I mean, they seem reasonably sort of obvious. We are spending a lot more time online, but just give us the idea of investment fraud and the scale of this particular problem and why we're being captured by this particular fraud.
So the scale of the problem is that basically the Financial Conduct Authority revealed that throughout 2020, consumers lost just over £45,000 each on average when investing with fraudsters imitating genuine investment firms. So this is clone fraud, basically. And this has been a growing problem for some time. And it seems this is the latest wheeze of the cunning fraudster out there, is that what they do is they impersonate a financial company that is legit. And they do it in such a way that people think, oh yeah, I recognize that name. Yeah, I've heard of them. I'll put my money in there. And they don't advertise outlandishly high returns either. They're just the kind of better returns that will entice people in. Investment scams have surged 164% in 2 years, with losses hitting at least £135 million in 2020. And last year, Google blocked or removed 123 million financial service adverts worldwide that violated policies. But that's all around the world. And actually, there's many, many more than that that don't get blocked. Legit companies are being cloned and people are being fooled into paying money into fixed rate bonds that these places are advertising. So, for example, we had a story this week. An 83-year-old Marlene Goldstein came across a one-year bond from Aberdeen Standard Investments paying 1.89%. Now, 1.89% isn't exactly the kind of rate that you're going to be jumping up and down whooping about, but at the moment it looks pretty good. She filled out an application. She transferred two payments of £10,000 to an intermediary account of Bank of Scotland. She says after she made the transfer, she had a feeling that something was not right. She tried to withdraw her cash, but she never received it. It was then, just before Christmas, she realized she'd been scammed, reported it to Nationwide, but she wasn't refunded because she hadn't indicated the transfer was an investment and so wasn't shown a scam warning. So she didn't get scam warning. So she didn't then ignore the scam warning or anything like that. You know, she just transferred the money. Our colleagues over at Money Mail intervened. Nationwide agreed to reimburse her in full. But the building society said, as no error was made by the society, we initially held her liable for the loss. And the issue here is that it's like the when somebody phones you up and convinces you that they're calling from your bank and you need to transfer money to a safe account kind of thing. We've discussed numerous times on this podcast. People are being fooled into transferring money to the scammers. And if that happens to you, you're in a very different position to if someone fakes the card machine so that it swallows your card and then steals your PIN number or gets your details somehow and then defrauds you. If you actually transfer people the money, then you're in a difficult position. And Phil Rolfe, who's an expert in this field, said to us, the problem is that the scam looks completely legit. Criminals create fake versions of investment company websites. They then pay significant money for digital advertising on search engines or social media. The ads lead to fraudulent sites. that offer a slightly above standard return for an investment or a pension product, for example, a 2.75% return. So he's not saying 40% returns, 2.75% return, and might claim it's guaranteed. It looks marginally better, but that's not enough to set the alarm bells ringing. The problem comes from the fact that when you are searching for stuff, these fake websites are appearing alongside legitimate companies. In some instances, they are paying search companies and social media to appear, and then search and social media tries to crack down on them, and then they pop up somewhere else with a different name. Now, in sort of total disclosure here, you know, obviously we have online advertising on This Is Money, right? Okay, and a lot, it's quite a bit of online advertising nowadays goes through exchanges. Now, we are very, very careful about who we allow to advertise on This Is Money. Stuff can always slip through, and then you have to crack down on it really hard. But we know from our experience that cracking down on this stuff can sometimes be a bit of a game of whack-a-mole. So I would say to anybody listening to the podcast, if you see a dodgy advert or an advert that you think is a bit iffy when you're reading our site, please email us at editor@thisismoney, because we will crack down on it ASAP. The concern is that maybe the search engines and the big social media companies aren't quite doing as much to crack down on this as they could do. And the problem is that once people click through, they go through to the site, they put in their details, they get a phone call from a slick salesperson, they encourage them to sign up. Everything Phil says here, he says it mirrors legitimate conversations. They might even send you a brochure that looks exactly like the real thing. The investor believes they're with a legitimate company, they transfer their money, and then unfortunately it is gone. Just because you recognize the name doesn't protect you. I mean, Aberdeen Standard Investments are a pretty big, well-known name. You know, you might find that someone's pretending to be an Aviva or someone like that. Aviva itself has actually set up a special place for people to crack down on this and has been trying to crack down on this. What you need to do is you need to very, very carefully check the website that you're going to. Don't respond to inbound phone calls. Someone calls you up out of the blue saying that they're gotten a great investment for you. Use legitimate comparison websites. And also the other thing is, if in doubt, the final tip here is wait, check, and validate. So you can find out the correct phone number for any one of these legitimate financial companies. Okay, so you need to look for their actual proper website, and you will find it with all of the other stuff that they do. It will, you know, okay, people are getting good at cloning these websites, but there will always be stuff about them that if you looked at it properly, you'd be like, that's not their actual website. You need to find their actual website, and then you need to call through on the number on there to their customer services, and you need to speak to someone, and you need to tell them exactly about the product that you've been looking at. And if it's a real one, then they'll be able to tell you about it, and if it isn't, then obviously alarm bells will be ringing. The other thing I would say is be very, very careful about any sort of sites that have a bit of a jumble of investments in there. So they'll advertise themselves to do with something like fixed rate bonds, compare fixed rate bonds, something like that. And then they'll have some fixed rate bond stuff in there. There might be a bit like property stuff, a bit of like small cap share stuff as well. It's all kind of links through to other things and links through to other things. Those are effectively like farms, lead farms for taking people in. And quite a lot of this stuff will go off to dodgy things.
So if I was to go online now to Google.
Yeah.
And I search for, I don't know, good returns investing or something. Is it highly likely that what's going to come up is there's going to be some scam site up there?
I think that people need to be aware that if they go into Google and type good returns investing, that some of the results that come up are going to be dodgy. I honestly think that if you need to be aware that if you are going to a search engine and typing in that kind of thing, if you type it into social media, certainly, anything like that, you've got to be aware that if you think that you'd like to search for that, then a scammer's going to have worked out that you would like to search for that. It's like walking out into a marketplace or onto the street or into the pub and saying, I'd like some good returns on investing, please. Now, it might be that most of the stuff you get back is totally legit from people in the pub when they turn around and tell you about their ideas. It might be a bit far-fetched. It might not be the wisest investing moves you've ever made, but you might find that most people are honest, and the vast majority of them will tell you about something that is actually legitimate. But there'll be someone sat there whose ears prick up and goes, oh, yes, sunshine.
So the fact that I've just typed this in has put up a red flag. Is that right?
It's not necessarily a red flag that you've typed that in. You need to be aware that typing that in, you're throwing your question open to everybody in the world who has access to putting stuff onto the internet, right, is what people need to realize.
I'm just worried.
That's a really important thing that people need to realize when they are using search engines or social media in general, and in terms of avoiding being scammed or fooled by anything, is that when you do that, you are literally inviting everybody who has the ability to post something on the internet to come to you and tell you about the stuff they want to tell you about. And as I said, if you walked out onto the street and shouted that, you wouldn't trust every single person who came up and gave you an answer.
That's the sort of things that we can do. We can help ourselves and we can look out for. But Phil has been really concerned. He's calling for urgent action. And I assume that's at a governmental and a business level. But what, I mean, you've just explained the situation for This Is Money, which you would expect a very legit financial website to be absolutely clean as you like. And hopefully you are. But you know, these things can slip through the net, as you said. So what can happen that will make a meaningful difference? Because £45,000, I don't know about you, Simon, but I mean, I certainly couldn't afford to lose £45,000. And the way that you've described it sounds, I mean, it's so difficult. They are getting so sophisticated.
Yeah. And actually, while you were speaking, I just Googled good returns on investment. Now,
I did wonder, because you went really still, and I thought maybe the connection had gone there, and it was a connection failed. Mine came up for wine and scotch, and then it came up for the FCA.
What's interesting here, and I don't know what percentage of people totally get how Google results work. For example, does everybody know about the fact that the stuff at the top is an ad and is paid for, and then the stuff underneath it is organic? I mean, does everybody know that? No, I don't think everybody does. So at the top, well, actually in the middle, in the sort of actual, you know, proper organic search returns, this stuff looks pretty good. Okay. I've got an article from a 10 best investments in 2021. It's an article from a site called Bankrate. What's a good return on investment from The Balance? Return on investment, what to expect from Motley Fool? And then some other articles, you know, a pension investing section somewhere. Where should I invest £100,000 to generate income? What's the best place for your money? And then I've got something, 10 best high return investments in 2021. I'm a bit not so sure about that one. But the adverts around there is a mix of legitimate and So I've got some Scotch whiskey investment.
Oh, you got the same too.
Yeah, I don't know. I might be a bit wary on that one. I've got the FCA, investment guidance, high return, often high risk. This is the FCA trying to intervene here and try to stop people from being scammed. Yeah. Okay. Then I've got invest £250 and get £13,650. You don't know how easy it is.
Oh, I didn't.
Okay. I've not done my due diligence on this, but I'm going to say that I think this one might be a bit iffy. At the risk of slandering someone. Yeah. Looking for a high return, invest in gold at an 18% discount. Can you invest in gold at an 18% discount? Long-term store of value? A genuine 18% discount? I don't know about that one. Maybe it might be exaggerating a bit on the old headline there. I've got a Hargreaves Lansdown advert, and that is Hargreaves Lansdown, obviously legitimate.
I've got gold, one of those, yeah.
Gold Investment UK, free from capital gains tax. That, to me, seems definitely more legit than a promise of investing in gold at an 18% discount. And then I've got invest £200, get from £2,000, start from £200 into future. That doesn't look that great to me either.
Oh, I've got that one too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the issue is when you Google something like fixed rate bonds, actually. And then you start to, because the problem is that is exactly the kind of thing that lots of people are going to put in, savers are going to put in. And there is definitely some legitimate companies there advertising, and there are definitely some other ones that I would be very wary about. So it's a,
so the only thing done. And if you want to play along at home, please do type in and see what you get and let us know. Yeah, but look, can anything be done about this? I'm talking at, you know, business, governmental level, those sorts of, I mean, you said there about the Hargreaves Lansdown, and I'm sure, absolutely, hopefully, that that is a legitimate, but you've just explained that some of these investment firms clone. So, I mean, that's awful for the companies, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's terrible. It's, I mean, it's really bad for them, kind of business wise. You know, it's terrible for them. Unfortunately, it's a very easy thing to do for a fraudster to clone someone's website. You've got the FCA, right? You've got their register. You've got their Scam Smart tool. You can use those. You can go to legitimate sites where you can compare stuff. Obviously, this is money. If you're looking for fixed rate savings, this is money.co.uk/save. If you're looking for investment platforms, this is money.co.uk/platforms. There's other sites that are legitimate. Compare wealth managers, find a wealth manager. These are for people who will help you invest and stuff like that. And there's lots of obviously other legitimate websites out there, you know, rivals to us. What can be done? There needs to be a concerted effort between financial firms, who obviously this is a big issue for, the regulators, the FCA, etc., the social media giants and the search engine giants, to really come down on this like a ton of bricks and to act quickly. Now, one of the problems that we have heard is that people from big financial firms, senior people at financial firms, getting in touch with some of the social media search giants, etc., are getting a bit of the runaround from them. More of the runaround than you would expect if you contacted them and explained that you were someone quite high up from one of these companies. The FCA sometimes, we feel, can be too slow to act on stuff that's flagged and get it removed. But then you need the search engines and the social media people to come down and get it removed. Something could certainly be done about improving the filters in some way on the who is able to advertise. But the problem is, it's such a vast market that it's very difficult to deal with. And we've recently highlighted the stories of two readers who collectively lost £80,000 to clone investment scams. We've got another one that we're dealing with at the moment. In 2019, we reported on how victims lost more than £70,000 to scammers who impersonated Dutch bank ABN AMRO. But that hadn't been blacklisted, even though we had reported it previously to the FCA. So it needs a concerted effort from everyone involved. But amongst those people who need to make a concerted effort is ourselves, to be just a lot more wary about what gets served up to us when we go searching for things online.
All right, then. Let's move on from this, because could something be about to be done for those 250,000 mortgage prisoners in Britain? A new law could help those who've been struggling after taking out mortgages with lenders that went under during the financial crisis of 2008. Now, those loans were then sold on to investment firms, which don't offer new mortgages, many finding themselves as a result trapped on high interest rates and unable to switch in a subsequent time, of course, of rock bottom rates. Terrible stories we're hearing of hardship, poor mental health, family breakdowns, and even homelessness. Simon, just explain the problem and how we got to where we are.
So, pre-financial crisis, there was a big mortgage boom, easy credit lending, lots of new lenders coming into the market, or existing lenders who were operating at high scale. And then there was a crash and a credit crunch, and lots of lenders either pulled out or in some cases had to be rescued, stroke, went bust. Obviously, most famously, Northern Rock. The mortgage books, which is a very detached phrase for that encompasses all of the people who own homes having borrowed money off them. So homeowners, basically, let's call them homeowners rather than mortgage books, were passed on to other people who would effectively buy their mortgages as an investment. And then they were taking the money from them over the years. Now, the problem is that the people who've bought these as investments or are running the mortgage books, or the homeowners, as we should say, don't do new business. So people are stuck on these mortgages and unable to move away from them because their circumstances have changed. Maybe they're in negative equity. Maybe their income has fallen substantially. Maybe they have gone self-employed, and they can't find another loan elsewhere, which seems crazy, doesn't it? Because it's more than 10 years on now, and we've had a little bit of a mortgage market boom in that time. Obviously, things have dramatically slowed down over the last year in the pandemic with the pulling of 5% deposit mortgages and things like that. But prior to that, banks were pretty keen to lend and going easier on their criteria. But there is still a chunk of people who are unable to leave the people who they are paying their monthly mortgage payments to. And in these cases, these people haven't been keeping up with their mortgage payments. They've been paying them month in, month out, month in, month out. But they're paying very, very high rates. They're paying standard variable rates, perhaps 5 or 6%, which compared to a normal lender, standard variable rate is about 3.5% to 4.5%. But compared to actual mortgage rates that you can get new on the market, that's like, they're like 2, 2.5% in a comparison. So they're paying way over the odds for their mortgages, but they can't get out of them and they can't find a new deal. Hence the term mortgage prisoners. And there's been a lot of pressure put on to the government, to regulators, to the people running these mortgage books, to play fairer by these people. And I don't think that these people are being played fair by. The people running the mortgage books argue they are, but I don't think they're being played fair by. And I can only imagine how galling it would be to sit there and watch everybody else getting these super, super low interest rates on their mortgages while you are stuck there paying over the odds. And perhaps you're in, you know, perhaps you're in negative equity. And if you'd have been on a lower mortgage rate, you'd have been paying back, you could continue to pay back the same amount per month, but you would have eaten into the equity, and you would now actually be comfortably in positive equity. But instead, you've just been keeping your head above water.
Yeah. I mean, it's more than galling. We've been hearing, I mean, horrendous stories of when people simply can't afford to keep up with that. What is this new law? And bearing in mind, we're talking here about 2008. That's 13 years ago.
Yeah. So the government has a chance to change the law and help mortgage prisoners. There's an all-party parliamentary group on mortgage prisoners, which is chaired by a Labour MP, Seema Malhotra. A new legal measure currently going through Parliament, which could offer some help. And it's an amendment to the Financial Services Bill. It's passed through readings in the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and it would require the FCA to introduce a cap on SVRs charged to customers that have mortgages with inactive lenders and who are not able to remortgage with a different lender because of their circumstances. It also require the FCA to make rules allowing mortgage prisoners with inactive lenders and unregulated entities to be able to access new fixed interest rate deals. The rates would be set by the FCA, taking into account the rates offered to customers of active lenders. Also includes measures to prohibit the government from selling mortgage loan books from authorised to non-authorised entities, helping to prevent the creation of more mortgage prisoners in the future. Now, they're slightly controversial, some of these, because the problem is with a cap, as was the argument against the energy price cap, is what you then get is you just get people bunching against the cap. So if, say, you introduce a cap and the cap is 4.5%, everybody's going to go to 4.5%. Should the FCA be stepping in and, you know, issuing diktats to lenders and saying you must offer these people these rates? Is that the kind of intervention that you want? The argument counter that is that, well, the market and the mortgage lenders have had a long time to sort this out, and people are still paying very, very high rates. And maybe they should just introduce a cap and make the cap low enough that even if people do bunch around it, that most people actually save money and it does some good. And maybe we do need to come up with some kind of innovative scheme in order to get people out of these mortgages that they're locked into. Because to go back to the, you know, to the real people here, we've got somebody here, Rachel Neal. Highest rate she's paid on the mortgage is 5.75%. She said, my husband and I took out our interest-only together mortgage with Northern Rock in 2006. The together mortgages were the ones where you could borrow more than 100%. We were told by our independent advisor this was one of the best products on the market and that we could do 2 years on interest-only and then move on to a repayment mortgage. That suited us because we were just about to get married. It was our first house and it freed up a bit of money. In late 2008, we tried to switch to a repayment mortgage, but the crash had happened and everything had changed. They told us that we no longer passed affordability and we had to stay on interest only. As the years went on, I became seriously ill with Crohn's disease and at one point was in hospital for about a year. That affected my husband's business. We fell into some arrears, but we completely caught up. In 2016, our mortgage was sold on from NRAM, Northern Rock Asset Management, to Landmark, and we asked again if we could move on to repayment. They said that because of our interest rate, which was about 5.75%, we simply wouldn't be able to afford it. They also said that because they didn't have a lending license, they wouldn't be able to offer us any other products. We were really completely trapped. Our home has become completely unsuitable, and it starts to make me feel really uncomfortable and quite miserable. We have a two-bedroom home. We have two boys, one's 20, one's 13. They need their own rooms, but they still have to share. I have a huge amount of medical equipment, which needs to be kept sterile. I have to keep in my bedroom. My mortgage balance is exactly the same as it was when we started. I wouldn't even like to think how much I'd have paid off over the past 15 years. And the property has about £45,000 of equity in it. But our credit files are absolutely fine. There's been no missed payments for 10 years, but we still can't get another mortgage. The SVR cap for us personally would save us about £200, £250 a month, as it would take the rate down to about 2.1%. But there are other people in the UK Mortgage Prisoners Group for whom it would slash their payments by around £800 per month. That's huge. That's an income. And that's the money that could go towards paying off the mortgage. So, yeah.
Well, when we find out more, Simon, do let us know about that. But awful, awful stories. All right, then, after flirting with us for nearly 2 years, Marcus Bank has come in and livened up ISA season by announcing it will launch a tax-free cash savings account. All right, when I say livened, everything's relative. The account will pay a Best Buy rate of 0.4% and will launch on April the 6th in time for the start of the 2021-22 tax year. But will it drive up competition and push up rates? Doubtful. Isn't that right, Simon?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is only open to existing Marcus customers and does not allow previous year's ISA transfers. So you can only put new money into it. So good news, peeps. If you've already got a Marcus account, which lots of our listeners and readers do, you can open one of these and it'll pay you 0.4%, but you can't transfer any other old ISA money into it. But what's interesting here is that maybe these limitations suggest that the bank is still concerned about breaching British banking limits that would mean it'd have to ring fence Marcus and leave it unable to use UK deposits to finance parent company Goldman Sachs' investment banking operations, right? So there might be a technical reason for this, okay, which is what was said was the reason for why they had to try to shrink the number of people coming into the Marcus account or stall them completely. Because it closed its market-leading easy access account to new savers last June after it was inundated with customers and was concerned about breaching a £25 billion limit. It's understood to have around 500,000 savers and around £21 billion in deposits held in easy access and one-year fixed-rate accounts. So it's got a bit of headroom there. But the interesting thing is that this does give an indication that it's still interested in the UK savings market and in giving decent rates to UK savers. So could we see better rates down the line, or could we in fact actually see something worse? Could it be a precursor to another easy access rate cut from Marcus in the next 6 months? Maybe they're, you know, building up some balances by pulling in some cash ISA money that they think will be sticky. Basically, it's tough for savers, I think, is the ultimate,
which we knew
answer.
Anyway, but yeah, I mean, I'm a spurned lover of Marcus. I was lured into their high rates back in the day when we discussed it on the pod, and then it was just cut. And in the end, I took my money out actually and put it in Oxbury after we talked about that. Why not? Do good, farming and all that sort of thing. And I actually didn't close my account, could do, but it's just sat there. It was just laziness, I'll be honest with you. But it does mean that if I want to have their 0.4% cash ISA, then I can. I'm not sure I'll bother, but
it's market leading. I mean, you've got, you know, up there at the top of the cash ISA tables, you've got Nationwide's 1 year triple access online ISA. Again, a limit. You can only take money out of it 3 times in 1 year. Charter Savings Bank's easy access ISA. Paragon Bank's triple access cash ISA. And Leeds Building Society's defined access cash ISA. They are all paying 0.4%. And then you start notching down to 0.35%. What can you say, really? It's very difficult to. You're basically just effectively getting the tiniest of rewards for putting your money in a safe place where it's protected by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, really, aren't you? And also using up some of that ISA allowance so that in years to come you can hopefully move it to better rates. I think we're going to see even more money poured into investment ISAs this year as an upshot off the back of this. That's the only way I can see it going. But people need to accept that they're taking a risk with their money, and you know they could find over the short term that it goes down in value.
Yeah, it just seems to me less. Is it vampire squid? More kind of damp squib. But talking of which, actually, let's go here now. After such success in lockdown, we got less a steaming hot pepperoni passion pizza with the cheesy stuffed crust bits and more sort of soggy salad. As Deliveroo made its long-awaited stock market debut, shares tanked, wiping $1.8 billion from the tech takeaway firm's value.
Ow. Yes, not so good for Deliveroo on its float. Now, I mean, the interesting thing is that Deliveroo had already had to cut the valuation. Because it had gone for the lower end of its valuation. When you do a float, you give a sort of range of prices that you're going to launch at. And the upper end of the range was considered way too spicy. And there were some big, big institutional fund manager types who said, we're not buying in. It was cited as concerns over Deliveroo's business model, work practices, the way it pays its riders and things like that. I think it was probably the price wasn't right. I mean, you know, I like to think that fund managers just hadn't had a sudden case of the ethics overcome them. But I think if Deliveroo had been priced cheaply, we wouldn't have heard those complaints. But it still floated on the stock market at a lofty £7.6 billion and then rapidly lost some money just after shares started trading. They crashed from the starting price of £3.90 to as little as £2.71, cutting its market value by £2.3 billion. They eventually closed down 26% at 287.45p. One trading day does not a company make. There are many companies that fall on their debut and then go on to do well. There are many companies that fall after their stock market debut and spend some time in the doldrums and then go on to do very well indeed. Facebook, for example, didn't have a great first year on the market, and its shares have done all right since, up 14-fold or something like that, I think. If you'd have bought in after they slumped after that initial IPO, then you'd have done very well. The thing is, though, Facebook's a bit of a profit machine. Deliveroo isn't a bit of a profit machine. Mm-hmm. Deliveroo, I mean, it makes a loss. And it even made a loss last year when everybody was told to stay at home and demand absolutely surged for its services. And I think one of the more interesting insights into it came from James Anderson at Scottish Mortgage, an investment trust that has no issue with investing in companies on very, very lofty valuations if it thinks that they have a very bright and promising future, and has shareholdings in a number of food delivery sort of players, one in China in particular, and also Delivery Hero, which is comes out of Berlin. The one in China is Meituan, I think. But James Anderson, in an interview, said he wouldn't be investing in Delivery. Didn't think it was worth it. Said he thought that its market was too limited and it didn't have the scope for growth that the others had. So too London-based, too Europe-based, not in the high growth markets. Who knows what will happen next? Analysts said advisors when a company floats, they have advisors and they help them decide how to price it and float it and everything else like that, and charge handsomely for their services. They picked up £49 million amongst all of this, had mispriced the shares. Big investors had criticized. So Legal & General, Aviva, Jupiter and others had boycotted the listing. They weren't adding them to their funds. Obviously, it faces competition from people like Just Eat and Uber Eats, as well as the companies that I mentioned earlier. And it's a shame, really, because Deliveroo was seen as, for all its faults, as exactly the kind of float that the UK market needs, because the UK market's a bit light on exciting growth tech influenced companies, and we need to try to attract more of those here, you know, to try and tilt the balance from the stodginess of financials and miners and oil majors and things like that. I don't know, it's always difficult, isn't it, pricing something. People want to get their money because, you know, this is a way for people to cash in when a company floats on the stock market, but maybe aim to go low and then hope for a pop and you go up rather than go high and then have that horrible sinking feeling on your debut.
I saw actually a tweet by Aviva explaining why they weren't getting involved in this, and it was related to sort of ethical reasons. And it's so started a bit of a debate about whether it is your best place to change something when you're in it or by boycotting it. I mean, you could talk about Thierry Henry and Twitter here, or any sort of thing, or Brexit, dare I say. What are your views about that? Because mine was very much of, you know, the bold decision would surely be going for companies that had, if you question their ethics at the heart of what created them. And it's a bit worrying with a, we call tech startup, that it doesn't have that at its core.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I'm not entirely certain that I buy into the argument of you should buy into something at a very high price that you don't agree with some of its business practices and then try to change them. I mean, if you bought the entire company and then radically overhauled its business practices, I could see that, but yeah, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about buying a small stake of a company and then agitating for change. And I don't know whether that would happen. I do think that you're right, actually, going back to discussions on the last podcast and the podcast before that, that if you want to invest in a way that your money does some good, or at least not what you conceive to be damage, then you need to actively look for companies that put that at the heart of what they do, or constructed on that principle, or you know, are doing something that is changing something, you know, for the better. Now, that's not to cast any aspersions on Deliveroo. The concerns around Deliveroo are around like what their riders actually end up earning per hour, you know. But yeah, I do think it is a consideration. But I think for many people that it's not really a consideration that they make in many other parts of their lives, but it's not one that they often make when they're investing. They just go, will it go up?
Yeah, it's a bit like a partner. You're never going to change them. Just pick a good one from the start. Just one final thing on this one, though. You talked about, you know, it was priced very highly, but in terms of the model, I guess the premise of Deliveroo, does this say anything about what investors think of our eating choices going forward, or perhaps the scalability of a company like this? I mean, is it specifically about delivery, or is it something about habits?
No, it's about barriers to entry, I think, more than anything else, and opportunity to scale up and grow the size of the business and market share. And I think that the main issue with Deliveroo or any of these food delivery companies is that it's not that difficult to set up a rival. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do. Obviously, there's their kind of proprietary software thing going on, but can they then take that? They then have the ability to take that and use that in other markets. But whatever market you go to, the food delivery thing already exists, and there's a lot of players vying for share within that market. Whereas if you take something like Ocado, for example, which for years and years and years was a real jam tomorrow investment, you know, you can't have your jam today, you can have it tomorrow, you can have it tomorrow, you can have it tomorrow. But And people who invested in Ocado and said it was a great business, right? It's not an online supermarket, it's a tech company. It's not an online supermarket, it's a tech company. And the critics were like, it's an online supermarket. And, you know, and it's going to get hammered by the likes of Tesco, et cetera. When, you know, actually, it turned out that it could sell that stuff into other people. And lots of other people are interested in, you know, the software and the systems that it's got and everything like that, because there's lots of supermarkets and retailers out there who need that kind of thing and are happy, you know, to buy it in. And Ocado has got some best of breed stuff going on. I mean, those robot warehouses and everything like that are absolutely amazing. I don't think that the food delivery apps are comparable in that sense. And I was not even one of those people who was totally convinced by the whole Ocado story. I don't even know whether I still am, but I definitely think when I look at Ocado versus Deliveroo, then I think I'm a lot more convinced by the Ocado story than I am by the Deliveroo story.
All right. Well, I want to know how convinced you are with our next story. Yeah, finally, in time for your 2021 summer staycation, Volkswagen has confirmed it will sell a compact camper van in the UK from a month's time. Best part, less than 30 grand. But is it any good? Simon, the camper van, though, the must-have accessory. Camper van, fancy it?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a couple of things to unpick here, isn't there? I mean, for example, there's the reason why people say that, you know, you should hold on to your car over your house because you can sleep in your car, but you can't drive your house. There is the fact that if you do want a camper van, and many people do, craved one already before the pandemic, and now that the pandemic is here and they've been stuck at home, they have even more dreams of and wanderlust and imagine themselves taking themselves off to some remote space and wild camping there, communing with nature, not having to worry about the ridiculous prices being placed on holiday homes in the UK because they're concerned they're not going to be able to leave the UK and they want to, like, you know, socially distance and everything. So a camper van sounds ideal. It's your own little space. So secondhand camper van prices have gone through the roof and they're harder to get hold of. And anybody who's got a decent one is either asking a lot of money for it or holding on to it. To the economy where of renting these things out, we've covered this before on This Is Money and on the podcast, of sites that are like the sort of Airbnb for camper vans, you can turn it into a stream of passive income. To the fact that VW has got such great demand for its iconic California camper van, the classic VW camper van that dates all the way back to those VW camper vans of the 60s. That it not only has the California, it has the Grand California, which is the bigger van based on its long wheelbase panel vans, has a bathroom inside the camper van, has a separate sleeping quarters within there. The Mercedes has got a camper van to rival the California now as well. And there's loads of places that will do a conversion of any type of van. But what you need is a smaller, more accessible camper van. And this is where we come in with the VW Caddy California. Now, this is VW's smaller, sort of like car-sized van, okay? And it's turned it into a camper. And I must say, I really like one of these. This is cool.
It's very small.
It's very small, but it's compact. And that's good.
Yes.
And it has...
You could say bijou or whatever you want to. It just looks...
But you want to be outside communing with nature, not sitting inside. I mean, okay. There is that...
It's a state car that you can stick a tent on the back.
And this is the trick up its sleeve, is this tent, I think. Right. So basically, this is ideal for a couple. It features a double bed that folds out over the rear seats. Now, interestingly here, it's not the rear seats that fold down to make the bed folds out over them. It's got a micro kitchen that folds out at the back, nicely stashed under the tailgate, okay? So that means that you can do your cooking sheltered from the elements if it's raining, which it might be in the UK raining. And because you might be spending quite a lot of time sitting in your van while it's raining, it's got some comfort stuff inside. It's got a 1.4 meter panoramic glass roof, which allows you to lie in bed and stargaze in the evening or lie in bed and look at the rain coming down on the ceiling as you lie in your van using your iPad or your phone because you're on a British staycation in a VW Caddy, California. The pictures here, I mean, they've even got little fairy lights strung inside their van, and it's like an idyllic scene outside. But it's nifty. It's really good. But the trick up its sleeve is that tent, as I said, because the tent totally changes the game. It's not just a normal tent. I'm going to try to describe this for our listeners. It attaches to the back of the van, so it creates it as one unit. So you could go from the tent into the van, right? Okay, no door between the two. So effectively, you're extending your van. And you've got a section that then goes into the main tent section, right? Domed, high enough to stand up in. But then that then comes off to the side as well. You've basically, I mean, you've almost tripled the size of your living space with a tent. And this would be really cool, I think, because this suddenly turns it into something that you could use as a family. I got two kids, age 10 and 8. This thing's got back seats. If you had the tent, you could have the tent come out the back. We could quite happily go away in this, make our little camp, and stay there. Now, there is one small problem, okay? You got to get all your luggage in somewhere. So you might need to travel a bit light. Now, as someone who did take a VW California, the real deal camper van, around France for 2 weeks a couple of years back, and did do a proper 2,000-mile road trip review of it, I thought it was awesome and I loved it. That's got the pop top with the double bed in the top and then a double bed downstairs. But it's got you surprising amount of luggage space in there. You do have to kind of squeeze things in, and there's cubby holes and things like that. I'm looking at the Caddy California and I'm questioning whether you could fit anywhere near as much stuff in the Caddy California as we fitted in that California. And I must admit, other than the inflatable canoe that we took with us, which possibly wasn't entirely necessary, but did add an extra element of adventure to the journey, there wasn't much luggage that we didn't need that we took in there. So luggage space might be an issue, but I think this would be great. I'd love one of these. 30 grand, basically. Expect them to absolutely fly off the shelves, I suspect.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't say no. It just looks like an estate car with a nice tent on the back. Which
it is.
A nice tent can cost you, a few hundred quid, maybe. A good one. Yeah, £30,000, a few hundred quid. I don't know. Let me know what you think.
But the car bit. You've got to pay for the car as well, haven't you? The VW, the Caddy California, you're not just paying for the tent and the sleeping equipment.
But if you've already got a car, just open up the boot. I mean, obviously you don't have quite as nice sort of sleeping space, but you can fit more luggage in, get a tent out. Do you know what I mean, Simon?
Well, people do that. You know, they do. You could get a decent estate car, nice roomy estate car, maybe for secondhand, £5,000, right? Then what are you going to need to do? You're going to need to fit some kind of roll bed scenario in there that you can create to make it properly comparable. But you can't just put the seats down and lie on the seats. You need to create some kind of bed scenario in there. You're going to need to get some curtains and everything around it, create some cubby holes and things like that. I reckon all that work, if you do it properly, you're looking at maybe £5,000. And then, yeah, maybe you spend... You can get tents that do attach to vehicles. You spend, but going to probably cost you a grand, maybe 500 quid to a grand for a really good one, perhaps. I'm not entirely certain. But yeah, I mean, you could do that. You could DIY it. And I think there are lots of people out there who do that kind of thing. I take my hat off to them.
Well, if you've
the only thing I would say is people buy camper vans dreaming of the image that in their minds or the pictures that they're sold of being out there in the wilderness with no one near them while camping and things like that. The reality of that is a little bit different, because if you're going to do that, you need to accept that you're probably going to end up parking up somewhere and staying somewhere that you're not really meant to park up and stay, because it is quite hard to find places to just kind of wild camp. People don't really mind you parking up and staying there, but whether you can kind of really spread out like they do in the photos and stuff, what most people are going to do is they're going to end up in a campsite.
Yeah.
Surrounded by other people.
With
kids.
Not having spent 30,000 on a car.
And not that much room. Tent. Yeah, and then you think, well, maybe it'd be nice to have like a £30,000 mini camper van, but maybe I could just spend a couple of £1,000 a year going on holiday. And
there you go, Simon. I've convinced you out of it, haven't I? Do let us know. Take a look at the pictures. If you've made your own camper van, that'd be cool too. But you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or any pictures of camper vans, anything you'd like them to look into, including your camper van, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. Join in the debate and read comments. And if anybody has any insight in turning estate cars into mini camper vans and the logistics and cost of doing it, we would absolutely love to hear from you by email, preferably with pictures of your homemade camper van.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.